It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Milwaukee public schools are required to bring back dozens of police officers on campuses. It's one of the stipulations struck in a deal with the legislature last year to increase aid to Milwaukee. But a new study finds school-based law enforcement fails to improve school safety. Call in with a question. You can share your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Ben Fisher is an associate professor at UW-Madison's School of Human Ecology, where he teaches in the Department of Civil Society and Community Studies. Ben, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. Good morning.
So in schools around Wisconsin, there is controversy over whether to have police officers in schools. How do you view the arguments over the presence of police officers in our schools?
Well, it's certainly not a conversation that's unique to Wisconsin. That's something that's happening across the country. On one hand, we see these severe problems with gun violence happening in our country that far too often happens in schools, and everybody wants to do something. And it, for decades, has been a really natural sort of gut reaction to put police in schools. On the other hand, we have advocates across the country who have been pointing to having police in schools as something that's actually harmful for students, that especially students of color, where it's increasing the links to the criminal justice system and increasing punishment of students. So there's this real, I think, emotional tug of war that's happening around this issue.
As you mentioned there, there is that concern that these school resource officers push students into the criminal justice system through excessive punishment and just the presence of law enforcement contact. Is this a concern? Is this a concern of yours?
Yeah. So from the research that I've done and the research that I've read from other folks, one of the most consistent findings has been that schools with police in them have higher rates of suspension of, especially of students of color. And while we don't entirely know the mechanism by which this is happening, we certainly don't think that police are sort of like writing the suspension slips or something like this. We think it contributes to sort of this overall climate in schools where it's more focused on sort of punishment and control rather than restoration and making things right. So it's certainly a trend that we're seeing in the research, and more work is still needed to kind of unpack exactly why it's happening.
But what do you think of a school resource officer who says, look, you're getting me wrong, Ben Fisher. My job is to help students and keep them out of trouble. What needs to be clarified about this role?
Yeah, that's a fair question. And actually, one of the things that I've said probably a dozen times is that when I speak with police who work in schools, I like all of them that I've met. They seem to work well with students. They have kids' best interests at heart. But there's something about the institution of policing that sort of, regardless of how nice an individual officer is, there's something about sort of that law enforcement that when it's put in school context, it just doesn't work right. I don't know if it's because there's sort of a misalignment of the fundamental goals of each of those institutions or what, but it's certainly a consistent finding in the research. And again, we don't know if that's because individual officers are the ones, recommending suspension. It's possible that, their job is to prevent crime, prevent bad things from happening. And so their job is to watch out for stuff in the school. And so maybe just having that extra person to watch out for stuff is letting school administration know about more problem behaviors that lead to things like suspension. So I'm certainly not placing the blame solely on cops here. Schools do a lot of things on their own to punish students, but there's sort of the mix of those two has not led to the best results thus far.
The best outcomes. Discussing police presence in schools with Ben Fisher, an associate professor at UW-Madison, where he studies school safety. And you can join the conversation. Call in with a question. You can share comments at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Ben, there was a May 2022 poll commissioned by the Wisconsin Professional Police Association finding nearly 2 in every 3 Wisconsin residents think police improve safety in schools. What is misunderstood about this issue?
Yeah, I don't know that misunderstanding is actually the word that I would use for it. I think the issue is that this idea of safety is something that gets defined differently by different folks, and all of those definitions are valid in some sense, but they're not always the same. So when parents think of school safety, they might have this sort of imagination in their imagination, ideas about their kids being physically protected in school from outside threats around, especially around gun violence. That's such a major issue that we hear about in the news. When principals think about school safety or teachers, it might be sort of a sense of order and that the hallways aren't chaotic. When students think about school safety, maybe it's around sort of their more emotions and maybe things like bullying in schools. So this idea of safety and school safety is really amorphous. And so when we talk about that in the public sphere, we never sit down and define exactly what we mean by school safety. We just sort of understand that people will or assume that people are understanding it in the same way. So for 2/3 of Wisconsinites to say that police increase school safety, my question is, what sort of, when you understand school safety, what are you thinking about? I think that is coupled with the fact that sort of in this country more broadly, we for decades and decades have had this sense that police are going to solve a lot of social problems. We have police get involved with things like homelessness. We have police get involved with addiction and mental health issues. And so there's sort of something ingrained in the value system of our country to think that police are going to be the answer to a lot of these social problems when, from a research perspective, we see that they're not.
Let's bring on a call. Dwayne in Westfield. Dwayne, hi, go ahead.
Hi, how you doing? I mean, I was growing up in the 80s and stuff like that. We've had resource officers there, but they didn't really do very much. I mean, all they mainly did was mainly just make sure that people were getting off the buses, school, and everything else, and that was about it. But times have now changed, and now my granddaughters are going to be going to school with stuff like this. And I mean, am I worried about them having to worry about all these other officers instead of them trying to focus on going to school? They don't need to be doing this because, like you said, they're not really doing very much. I mean, you'd almost have to have a resource officer for every single student to do any really good. So why are we wasting all this extra money for resource officers that really obviously has been proven it hasn't gone very far to maybe actually fixing the problem to where trying to keep the kids safe and actually improve the schools?
Dwayne, thanks for the call. Ben Fisher, what is your reaction to some of those insights? You know, Dwayne, looking across generations at the role of school resource officers.
Yeah, it's a great question. Thanks, Dwayne, for sharing your experiences. We don't have a lot of information about what SROs were doing in schools more than 10, 15 years ago, actually. So we have a little bit of history of sort of how common they were, but don't know a lot about what they were doing in school. So it's hard for me from a research perspective to shed much insight on that. I think, Dwayne, one of the things that I heard in your comment was a call for doing things that actually do work in schools to make schools safe. A couple of things that I really point to when I have these conversations, and other researchers do as well, are tried and true things that we've been doing in schools for a long time, but are really hard work. And it's not just a program you can buy or a staff member you can hire. And that's investing in relationships between adults and students in the building, making sure that all the students know that there's at least one adult in the building that trusts them or that they can trust and has their best interests at heart. Foster a sense of belonging in the school where students have a pride in being there and being part of that community. So if we want to sort of improve student behavior in schools, those are things that we can think about. And then, of course, the gun violence issue is a whole nother set of concerns. And I think the answer there doesn't seem to be anything around sort of making schools into fortresses so that we can still own our guns and do with them what we please. But in my view, the solution lies in limiting our access to guns in some way.
Ben Fisher is an associate professor of civil society and community studies in UW-Madison School of Human Ecology, lead author of a study on the effectiveness of school-based police officers. Call in with the question. You can share your views at 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A new study examines the effectiveness of having police officers in schools, concludes they're not providing benefits to school safety, but escalating school punishment. Be part of the conversation. Call in with a question. Share your perspective at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Ben Fisher is an associate professor at UW-Madison School of Human Ecology, where he teaches about civil society and community. Ben, this month, the Justice Department issued the report criticizing how police responded to the active shooting at Robb Elementary in Uvalde, Texas. And the report called the response a failure in leadership, decision-making, tactics, policy, and training. Why have police failed to stop mass shootings at schools?
Yeah, it's a question I think the whole country wants answers to. We, from a research perspective, school shootings are incredibly rare incidents. Now, to listeners, rare incidents, what do you mean? I hear about these, it seems like once a week or once a month. And that's true. So that they happen far more frequently than they ought to. And they're tragedies every single time they happen. But statistically, if you think about the tens of thousands of schools nationwide and each school day, the likelihood of a school shooting happen at any given school on any given day is so very small. So these are statistically rare incidents, and that makes them really hard to study, to identify patterns, to be able to predict them and understand their characteristics. So if we have a hard time even understanding how they're going to happen, when they're going to happen, why they're going to happen, it makes it even harder to design effective prevention and response strategies. So I can't speak to sort of the specific tactics that get used in any given police department or school, but from a statistics perspective, there just happen to be such rare incidents that it seems especially hard to sort of prepare for them.
It then would make it hard to make a connection to the role of school resource officers in such situations?
Yeah, that's right. The school resource officers are, you know, there's a lot of things that they can predict about their days, like when students are going to arrive, when they're going to be in the hallways, when they're going to go home. It's even probably a little bit more predictable when there's things like fights that will happen in hallways. That's certainly a lot more common occurrence than a school shooting. But an SRO might go their whole career and never encounter an issue with a shooting in a school. Just knowing what to expect and knowing how to respond is so different from incident to incident that they just might not know the best way in their school for the thing that could happen.
Let's bring in Reggie in Oshkosh. Reggie, hi. What would you like to bring up?
I just wanted to know if there was a way to transition it back to like when I was in school on the East Coast in the 90s. It was about making sure the whole child grew and learned in school with support from counselors and advisors and people we felt safe talking to. And it seems like in the last 10, 20 years, we've moved so far from that to where there's nobody kids trust in school, especially the officer who's probably, they view, trying to get them on something.
Reggie, thanks for the call. Ben, where do school resource officers interact at all with counselors and advisors? And is there a diminishing supply of those types of people in schools when you have staffing of school resource officers?
Yeah, good question, Reggie. So one of the things that I thought about when I was listening to your question was some federal legislation that I heard about a couple years ago. I think it was called the Counseling Not Criminalization Act, where it was proposing that funding be removed from police and schools and repurposed for things like counselors, social workers, school psychologists. So there is this sort of conversation that's happening, even at the federal level, around doing the sort of thing that you're proposing. And that act didn't get a lot of traction, but it is the sort of thing that, again, at the federal level, folks are talking about. And in terms of what's happening on the ground in schools, it's super varied. We see there's a lot of schools across the country where the SROs work very closely in collaboration with the counselors and school administration and a lot of school staff. We've also seen that there's a lot of schools that have cops there and they don't have counselors. And so there's sort of not that person who's like devoted to that mental health role in schools. It's unclear if they're always choosing to spend on one over the other, or if they could have both. A lot of that is varied, and a lot of it is frankly unknown at this point.
Ben Fisher, associate professor at UW-Madison, studying school safety and looking at the police presence in schools. You can join in questions and comments, 800-642-1234. Ben, have you looked at whether police presence in schools can help children actually feel safer?
There's been very little research on that. And the research that has been done I think doesn't sort of rise to the level of being able to draw strong conclusions about like cause and effect sort of things. One study that I did was a mixed method study, meaning we used both survey research of students and also did focus groups with a handful of students. And we found some pretty sort of interesting tensions in our findings. So, one of the things that we found through our surveys was that young people said that they felt safer because they had a school resource officer in the building, and that they could protect them from danger. But when we spoke with them in the focus groups, the students really conveyed that the sense of danger that they had about their schools was because there was a school resource officer. It was almost as though the logic was, we have a police officer in our school, there must be something we need protection from. Mm-hmm. And so we got the sense that it tuned them into a sense of danger that maybe wasn't real, but they still felt like the officer was going to protect them from that danger. So it's not as straightforward a question as one might think, at least in the study that we did.
So there seems to be so much more terrain, so much more to explore on this issue. What are next steps for you? What are you hoping to explore about school safety in the future?
Yeah, well, right now I'm working on a study about what happens when we take police out of schools. I think that is a direction that's getting a lot of momentum. We saw it both in Madison and Milwaukee. There's been this successful push to get police out of schools, in Milwaukee, that's obviously been reversed. But a lot of schools are sort of taking that seriously. And so I'm using some national level statistics and data to understand when we take police out of schools, what are the implications of that for student discipline, for school-based arrests, and for racial equity across those issues. I wish my study was at a point where I had findings to share with you and to sort of preview what happens, but we're still working through that right now.
And you're still working through that data. Well, Ben, thank you so much for joining us and sharing your recent study.
You're welcome. It was a pleasure being with you.
Ben Fisher is an associate professor at UW-Madison School of Human Ecology, where he teaches about civil society and community. And you can go to our website, find more conversations there. Check out our program page to find conversations from the morning show. Visit WPR.org/mornings. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's the morning show here on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. As UW-Superior opens a research hub to advance community-based projects, we learn about the expertise of this center and the needs for data-driven projects in northwestern Wisconsin. You can call in with a question, share comments at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Daniela Mansbach is a political science professor at UW-Superior and a researcher for the new Center for Research and Evaluation Services. Daniela, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me. Good morning.
Good morning. And Emily Newman is here, Director of Institutional Research and Sponsored Programs at UW-Superior and a member of the research team. Emily, welcome.
Good morning. Thank you for having us.
So what community needs is this new center trying to address?
Well, I'll go ahead and take that first, Kate. Over the years, being in institutional research and sponsored programs, we would periodically receive requests from the community for analysis of data. It might be a school district or a private organization that emails me and says, hey, we have all of these surveys and we need someone to look at the data and tell us what it's saying. And we don't have either the capacity within our offices or we don't have the funds really to, you know, hire a private consultant that might be, very costly. So, I had gotten these requests over the years. Our Office of Institutional Research and Sponsored Programs is, of course, inward facing. So we primarily do research on student success. And I've had this passion for, our research, and if only we could serve the community. So I've been at UWS for over 10 years now, and things would just kind of crop up every couple years. We might get an email or a referral from someone else on campus that knew someone. And I always felt like there was something there and there was that need in the community. We didn't quite have it formalized, but then I brought this idea to our provost and said, hey, can we actually do a feasibility study? So we have the data, and we did end up doing a full survey of our community, nonprofit, state and federal agencies, a wide array, and we got some really interesting results. And I'll actually turn it over to Daniela because she was leading that feasibility study. But overall, what we found was, yes, in this area, there is a demand and that needs to be met.
Daniela, do you think that this applied research center will create stronger ties with the community, allowing for a better sense of what problems need solving locally?
Yes, I think that that's one of the main motivations that we have for this center. We are very interested in helping the community around us, and I think that it's kind of a way for both sides to really benefit. One of the things that I think make the center unique, it is that it is situated within a university. So we have so much expertise and it makes sense to use the expertise that we have. And also from the community side, when we did the feasibility study that Emily is mentioning, so we learned a lot of things, of course, about the community needs. And one of the things that they emphasized is that they are interested in researchers that are embedded within the community. So sometimes they have research needs, and they might actually outsource to like a company that might be, you know, in the East Coast or West Coast or like somewhere very different, but they are really interested in actually researchers that are here, that they know the community, that they can travel, that they can talk with the people. So we do think that that this research center will be able to help the community by doing that, and at the same time position us and our researchers within the community in a much more strong and clear way.
And Danielle, when you talk about expertise within the university, I mean, I want to bring up the fact that we've talked with you in the past about your research on abortion-related language and policy. And I'm just wondering, why become a researcher for this center?
For the center, we are not bringing our own research projects. Mm-hmm. On the one hand. On the other hand, we are bringing our research expertise. So to some extent, you kind of like started when you introduced this center that we are really interested in promoting evidence-based policymaking, evidence-based decisions, and all of that. And from my perspective, the theme itself matters less. So if we get to talk a bit about the projects we're currently doing, you'll see that they're very different in topic. But actually, the methods that they require, the type of data collection that they require is very similar. So for me, as my expertise as a researcher, as well as like my colleagues that are doing the projects with us, we are seeing that we have the tools, we have the skills to be able to help the community with the methods that are similar to what we're doing in our own personal research.
In your own specific areas, yes. Daniela Mansbach and Emily Newman, two researchers with the recently launched Center for Research and Evaluation Services at UW-Superior. You can join in questions and comments along the way, 800-642-1234. Emily, I understand that this research center is revenue neutral. How does the center decide the fees for services?
Sure. So we have a flat rate that we use when we're calculating an estimate for a client. So it's essentially, I work with our vice chancellor of administration and finance to figure out, okay, how much does it cost for, you know, myself, Daniela, we also have an assistant director, and any other faculty member. We use the salary amount that, someone is using to be employed at UW-Superior. And then basically what we're doing is sort of the client is buying their time in a sense. So it's a reasonable price. As state employees, we have our salaries are not tremendously high, maybe compared to private consultants. And then essentially we scope out the project and we do an estimate. So we're providing an estimate to clients based on our services. And that is the, the locked price, so to speak. So it's essentially revenue neutral. Our aim is not to profit from this. It's to serve the community with our expertise. And we use that. We calculate it based on what it costs to do what we're doing, in a sense.
Do you think, was there a void in some way before the center? We heard the sentiment from Fond du Lac Planning Division Director Jason Holliday that the absence of this type of research center can worsen urban-rural divides. What do you make of that, Emily?
I think that, I'll let Daniela speak to that one a bit because she spoke to Jason in particular.
Okay.
I would say though that in doing these interviews, we did found, and Daniela mentioned this before, that there is that need to feel a kind of, from a lot of our clients, that we felt. And it's been really amazing getting to know some of these clients. Like, as an example, someone we're working with Douglas County, I went to work the other day and then, walked to Douglas County and dropped off a contract to them. And just, I feel already like more connected. People want, we're in the Zoom age right now, but we've already felt this, that people really want that often face-to-face experience. So, both of the clients we're working with right now, we had that face-to-face experience with them. And they feel, like Daniela mentioned, that we live in this community, we're embedded in this community, and we're passionate about it. We work at an institution that part of our mission is to engage the community and region. So, like with that interview with Jason, one of the things we found in our interview too, it was this idea of who owns the data. And that's, kind of an interesting concept. But one thing we found, and this was also in talking with Jason from Fond du Lac and other people in the community, that sometimes people may do work for someone, or you hire a software company, and where are your data? Is it your data? Is it the agency's data that's doing the work for you? And part of what we, is a foundation of our center would be that these data that we help collect for people or analyze are their data, and ensuring that that's something, the things that we're uncovering and researching are precious, and ensuring that they have that ownership over the data. And Daniela, if you want to say any more about that, because you had interviewed Jason.
Very much like a client approach, Daniela. Is it, do you see it that way as well?
Yeah. So, and I think that Emily mentioned some of those things, but definitely we learned a lot when we did a feasibility study about what actually is needed in the community. As I mentioned, a lot of these organizations are conducting a lot of research, but they are not necessarily being able to be serviced by researchers or a center like ours that is so embedded within the community. And so definitely, like, I mean, this issue of who owns the data is something we learned or and heard about from the people we interviewed. The other part of this that kind of, like, I think just emphasizes how important it is that we are part of the community when we do that, is that we learn from the organizations that we surveyed that they might also need, for example, continuous training. No, like, I mean, maybe we collected the data today. Maybe we showed all of that to the people that are currently working in the organization, but there might be someone new coming, some people leaving, and they say, okay, what happens if, like, in a year or two, we need someone again to be trained to understand what you collected and what is the best way to use this data? So we say, you know what, we're here. Like, I mean, this is something that we can definitely offer. And related to that, this kind of, like, continuous need that is not just kind of like, oh, come in, do surveys, give me the tables, and then leave. We also heard from organizations and agencies that we interviewed that sometimes they also need some process facilitation. So maybe we collected different options, maybe we collected different data, but now they have a meeting of the board or of the city council or whatever kind of agency it is. And then they need someone to actually help them figure out what's the best route. And we said, you know what, we're here. Like, we can also follow you and help you throughout that process. So those are some of the things that I think that all the organizations that work with us can really gain from the fact that we are here.
Daniela Mansbach and Emily Newman, part of the recently launched Center for Research and Evaluation Services at UW-Superior. Call in with a question. You can share your thoughts at 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. As UW-Superior opens a research center focused on the analytical needs of the community, we learn about efforts to fill this niche for data collection and market analysis. Call in with a question. You can share your views, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Emily Newman and Daniela Mansbach are members of the Center for Research and Evaluation Services at UW-Superior. Let's bring in Jack in Madison. Good morning, Jack. What would you like to ask?
Hey, good morning. So I hear that UW-Superior's most famous alumnus is Arnold Schwarzenegger, and part of why I wanted to call was because it's not too many people in our state maybe knew about that, but yes, my main question for your guests is, how does the research that comes out of this new facility at UW-Superior connect with other campuses, or like if any of that research is shared or there's any collaboration between campuses and like how that whole process looked?
Jack, thank you. Emily?
Sure, that's a good question. At this point, we're not doing specific collaboration with other UWs, but you bring up a good point in that, you know, one of the things that is important to the center is utilizing the expertise within our campus. So as an example, if we have a client come and I can't meet that need with my expertise or Daniela can't, we tap in with another professor on campus. There may come a point where we want to serve a client in the community, an organization, and we don't have that expertise on our campus. We haven't thought about that as a phase because we're a newer center, but I appreciate your thoughts on that and that maybe in the future we would connect with someone with that expertise across campus or across the campuses in the UW.
Yes, and making a little bit more of a collaborative network there. Daniela, next month the center begins work for Douglas County looking at how to better use Superior's Head of the Lakes Fairgrounds. What questions are you trying to answer there?
Yes, we are very excited about this project that was just going to start soon. And so the main questions that we have is first figuring out, who's currently being using the fairground. We know that Douglas County is, relatively large county, and the specific fairground is situated within Superior. And we are interested in really figuring out what's the best way to use this area to serve the community, to serve all the residents. So we're interested in figuring out who's actually coming to events, who's not coming to events, why are they not coming to events, what does the community think will be the best way to use this fairground, who's currently benefiting economically from the events and who's not. So when we were approached by Douglas County, that's kind of like what they were trying to figure out. They have this fairground that is very active, that is bringing a lot of people to a lot of events almost year round. But they said, like, we're really lacking the data. Like, we do not know what we're doing well and what we should do better. So that's where we came into the picture. And that's what we were going to try and answer for them.
And can you walk us through a little bit what might be those steps to answer those questions and give the fairgrounds more visibility at, you know, the things that they excel at and the things that they're just not meeting?
Yeah. And we can. So the way that we're thinking about the project is, as I said, kind of like we're interested in starting with this question of what are the current benefits to Douglas County residents from the head of the Lakes Fairground. And that is something that we are interested in doing, collecting data by doing surveys, by doing interviews, by doing focus groups, by targeting, as I said, both the people that are currently attending and the people that are not.
Mm-hmm.
We're interested in serving some of the businesses to figure out what they think that they are benefiting, what they're not benefiting. So that's kind of like the first step, like to figure out what is currently happening and who is the target audience of that. The second part that we're interested, the second question that we're interested is to figure out how Douglas County residents would like to use the fairground. So are there events that they really would like to see? Maybe they are attending similar events in other counties and they would love to have, similar events here. Again, we are imagining us collecting data from the people of the county,
mm-hmm.
As well as some other agencies. And then the third part, which is kind of like based on both of those, is to provide recommendations as for the best use of those fairgrounds. And it can be similar to what is currently happening,
mm-hmm.
and it can be different. It might be a combination of the two. And that will be also by comparing to other comparable fairgrounds
mm-hmm.
and counties.
Mm-hmm. Emily, in our last minute together, the center offering services like data collection and analyses for grant submissions. Is there a need for help securing grants in the Superior area?
Yes, we definitely, in our feasibility study, that was one of the things that we asked about, not just data collection and whatnot, but, grant submissions, securing funding. At this point, we're not able to accommodate that service for the community, but it's definitely one that we heard in our survey from community organizations.
And would you consider that to be something that you envision happening for the center in the future?
I do. I mean, as a long-term goal, I think that if we could have a really robust, broad array of services to help clients and to help them secure the funding they need, that would be ideal. And as our center grows and we have more need, we may be able to accommodate that at our campus.
Emily and Daniela, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
It was a pleasure.
Us.
Emily Newman and Daniela Mansbach are members of the Center for Research and Evaluation Services that is at UW Superior. I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We learn about estate planning now and ensuring assets go where you intend them after death and how to successfully create a valid will under Wisconsin laws to avoid the probate process. Call in with a question. You can share your perspective at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Chantel Ringy is a partner at Hill Glowacki. That's a Madison law firm with practice areas in estate planning, elder law, and special needs planning. Chantel, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much, Kate.
So when a family member passes away without a will or an estate plan and the distribution of their assets usually determined by the probate court process, why do attorneys recommend strategies for avoiding probate?
Well, I don't know that I've ever met a client who was very excited to have to petition the court. That said, our Dane County commissioners are very friendly and relatively easy to deal with in my experience, but I think there's something about the court process that adds this sort of extra layer of stress for many folks. And if they can avoid that, or if my clients can know that their loved ones can avoid that upon their passing, then generally with a bit of planning, we're able to accomplish that.
Is probate a concern only for large estates, or is it a concern at all levels?
Probate is in Wisconsin a court proceeding that's required when there are assets that total in value $50,000 or more that don't otherwise pass by, let's say, joint ownership. For example, if you have a joint account and it's held with survivorship with the other owner, then that will pass automatically without the need for any kind of administration. Or assets that pass automatically because you've named a beneficiary to receive it and that beneficiary survives you. But otherwise, if you have at least $50,000 of assets that don't otherwise pass that way, then Wisconsin law does require the probate proceeding.
What factors might complicate a probate case and might be frustrating for surviving family members?
Well, it does involve, by statute, the publication of notice to creditors in the paper. So there's a legal notice that's published in the state journal if the person passed away in Dane County. And heirs at law need to be notified of the proceedings, and those persons may not be beneficiaries under the will or under the they would be under the rules of intestacy, but if you have a will, it doesn't mean that you've named your heirs, but yet in a probate proceeding, those persons must be notified. So, for instance, if you've named your unmarried partner or charities and excluded your heirs, nevertheless, if a probate is required, those persons need to receive a copy of the will, and they do have an opportunity to object to the proceedings. That's not always something that my clients like the idea of.
So it becomes a much more public process, as you said before.
It does, and there is a, an entry on the Wisconsin CCAP website. One could discern, I suppose, the size of the estate even from the inventory fee that's paid, and that is public.
We're talking about estate planning and alternatives to probate court with a Madison attorney. Chantel Ringy is here fielding your questions and comments at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Chantel, a deceased family member could have a written legal will and their family could still have to go through probate to settle the estate. What might be the cause of those situations?
That's exactly right. So having a will is something that hopefully we all consider and do. It's sort of a very basic fundamental step in planning for how your assets are distributed upon your death and who is going to handle that. But having a will alone does not allow you to avoid probate necessarily. Again, the trigger would be if you have assets that don't pass automatically that total 50,000. So those are the situations in which maybe you would like to consider establishing something beyond just a basic will. If you're motivated to allow your beneficiaries to avoid the probate process, then you might consider something along the lines of a revocable trust, which is also a very common estate planning tool, and really its sole purpose is to avoid probate of your assets upon your death. It's kind of this legal fiction, the revocable trust. It is essentially if you direct assets to your revocable trust, perhaps during your lifetime by titling assets in the name of the trust, and also oftentimes upon your death by designating the trust as the beneficiary on beneficiary designation forms. then those assets that are in your revocable trust upon your passing are not in your probate estate. And so, according to this, as I say, legal fiction, those assets get to avoid probate. So that's kind of in a nutshell, the structure of the revocable trust type of planning, which, as I say, is fairly simple to establish, and it's a pretty common estate planning tool. Many of my clients, once they learn of that option, are interested in pursuing it, and it's designed to avoid probate.
Then,
So having a will alone is not sufficient, unfortunately, to avoid the probate process.
and then how is a revocable trust or a living trust different from what is happening in the will?
So generally, the revocable trust will contain many of the similar provisions that you might have still in your will. They'll have the substantive provisions regarding who's to receive what upon your passing. But essentially, it is just designed to avoid probate. And I think the impetus behind the allowance to avoid probate in our statutes is just this notion that if you've done enough planning on the front end to avoid the process of probate, then our legislature feels that, okay, we can take a more hands-off approach. In the event of your death, we will allow the individual you've designated to serve as your successor trustee to administer those assets outside of the jurisdiction, the oversight of the probate court.
Let's bring on a call now, Laura in Grand Marsh. Laura, go ahead.
Yes, I'm trying to get these things settled with regards to will and trust, but what my concern right now is I wanted to know, my husband is concerned that if I pass away, how would he handle his finances? So I wanted to set up a durable power of attorney for finances. Can I do that on my own, or do I need an attorney to do that?
Laura, thank you. And if you could step back also for a moment, Chantel, and explain what a durable power of attorney is, what this person does.
That is an excellent question, Laura. A durable power of attorney is generally regarded as something that would allow an agent to manage your financial affairs, but it only applies while you're living. That's true with regard to the healthcare power of attorney as well. So, Laura, your husband's concern with respect to what he would do if you were to pass away would not really be alleviated by your establishing a financial durable power of attorney, because again, that type of form expires, so to speak, upon your death. So having something like a will or a trust would be something you'd want to pursue. At the same time, I don't want to slight the planning that is involved in establishing powers of attorney, because those are excellent documents to have in place if you are living and you suffer an incapacity, such as dementia or a stroke or some sort of acute emergency situation. It's in that context in which the agent who's designated under your durable power of attorney for finances would have authority to do things like access your bank accounts to pay your bills, file income tax returns on your behalf, contract on your behalf, and maybe apply for Medicaid. In terms of the question, Laura, that you need to work with an attorney to establish a durable power of attorney for finances. The answer is no, you do not have to. There is a statutory form in Wisconsin for a durable power of attorney for finances. The downside of not working with an attorney and just using the state form is that if you ever do have a real long-term disabling condition, that statutory form unfortunately lacks many of the planning authorities that we rely on at Hill Glowacki, for instance, to help the agent do things like maybe qualify you for long-term care Medicaid benefits. And those additional authorities can be extremely helpful. Another type might be to include the authority to create a special needs trust on your behalf. You're not going to find those authorities in the statutory form. So while having that statutory form is better than having nothing, and it is free, you just really need a notary to notarize your signature, it's of limited value depending on your circumstances.
Chantelle Ringy is a Madison-based attorney focused on estate planning and elder law, special needs planning. You can join the conversation at any point, calling in with a question, sharing your comments, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We examine the set of legal documents that outline how a person's assets will be distributed upon death. And you can be part of this conversation about estate planning and how to protect and pass down assets to family members. Call in with a question, add comments along the way, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. We have Chantelle Ringy, who's a partner at Hill Glowacki in Madison. Chantelle, parents can designate guardians of their minor children in the event of their death, and people who have lost a spouse can give power of attorney to an adult child to make health care or financial decisions for the surviving parent. At what stage of life do you recommend people start the estate planning process?
Well, I think you touched on what I've always regarded as the most important time of life to establish your estate plan, or at least some form of estate planning, and that is if you have children. So in Wisconsin, the only place you can designate a successor guardian for a minor child is in your will. The same is true if you're the guardian of a special needs adult child. You can designate or nominate, I should say, it still needs to be approved by the court, but you can make that nomination within your will. And what's more important planning than trying to ensure that your child has as streamlined of a handoff as possible in the event of your unfortunate passing? So that is extremely important. The other time of another instance might be I kind of hit on it. If you have an individual who is going to be a beneficiary of your estate and they have special needs, that's another occasion in which it can be very helpful to do some planning in advance so that when they receive whatever it might be from your estate, it doesn't, for instance, jeopardize their eligibility for perhaps public benefits that they're reliant upon. And to also make sure that there's someone who is able to administer those assets for their benefit. We do prepare in those instances special needs trusts for such beneficiaries. So that's another occasion when it can be extremely helpful and important to do a bit of planning on the front end.
As you bring up these scenarios, it makes me wonder, like, Is it permissible to shop around or inquire how much it will cost to set up these specific things or an estate plan? Or how do you find the expertise you need for your situation?
That's a good question. So, yes, I think it should be encouraged that consumers shop around, get an idea for, is this really in the wheelhouse for the attorney who you're considering doing the planning with? What is a ballpark of their fees, and what are you getting for those fees? A good resource is the Wisconsin chapter of the National Association of Elder Law Attorneys. The vast majority of those members are very invested in estate planning as part of their practice area. And they do have a directory online that you can find with just a Google search. But there are very well qualified, many well qualified attorneys in our area who do estate planning. But certainly call around, get an idea of the cost, don't walk into it blindly, and take some recommendations from family members or friends as well who maybe have gone through the process recently themselves.
Let's bring in Phyllis in Wausau with a question. Hi, Phyllis.
Hello.
What would you like to
My
ask?
question. Okay. My question is, I have a friend who died recently with no close kin, no will, no nothing. How is that property handled? What is the process?
Those can be very difficult cases, not necessarily because of the assets that need to be administered. But for instance, I have a very similar situation in one of my client matters at the law firm now, and woman passed away and she had no relatives in the area. And the rel she did have a will, but no one really knew any of the named beneficiaries. And so sometimes that means we're hiring an air search firm to locate people, or sometimes we at the law firm are doing quite a bit of online searching and making phone calls blindly to try to find who are the interested persons. If the person has no will, then essentially the state of Wisconsin has established an estate plan for them in our statutes, the rules of intestacy. So generally, if a person passes away with no surviving spouse and no surviving descendants, then you're looking at, do they have surviving parents? Perhaps not. If not, then you're looking at who are their surviving siblings and the descendants of any predeceased siblings. So you can imagine situations in which we're going pretty far down the chain and really trying to locate people who have no idea who the decedent is, or maybe never met him or her. So those are the cases where I really do encourage folks who have maybe charitable intentions or a very friendly neighbor who's always helped out, right? Establish an estate plan and designate who you really do want your assets to pass to, whatever it may be, large or small, because even if it's, $50,000 in your bank account, it could mean a fair amount of work for whoever is left to handle the affairs. And in the case that I have in my office right now, it's the legal guardian of the woman when she passed away who's handling the administration of the estate, just because she's a third party, just a retired attorney, but she was most familiar with the woman's affairs, and so she's the one who's kind of taking the rowing oar. They can be difficult situations.
We're discussing estate planning, all aspects of it, with Madison attorney Chantel Ringy and taking your calls. Let's go to Alicia in Little Chute. Alicia, hi. What would you like to bring up?
I have a complex situation. I have two children, a son and a daughter. And the son has been diagnosed as bipolar, seasonal affective, schizophrenic, possibly. He's terrible at handling money. The other one can handle the money, and I'm not sure. I can do well, and it's kind of, I'm kind of a 50-50 person for my children, adult children, and I'm not sure how to handle his portion because if he would get it, it would be gone in a heartbeat.
Alicia, I want to toss this over to Chantel to get your thoughts in a situation like this, Chantel.
Alicia, you're not alone in your situation and your concerns. We have many clients who have a loved one who they would ideally like to benefit in their estate plan, but their loved one has some special needs, or some inability to manage funds. When that's the case, we generally recommend a special needs trust. What that would allow is for you to appoint the person, or organization to manage your son's, in this instance, share of your estate after your passing. So that, as you say, he's not spending it without regard for his long-term well-being. So you have a trustee who's in charge of administering the assets for the benefit of the special needs person. The other thing that that trustee should be aware of
Very quickly.
Is what will distributions do in the way of affecting his eligibility for things like Medicaid?
And I'm going to just jump in here. Chantel Ringy, attorney, and you're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. When a person dies, we learn about the process to transfer their property and other assets with estate planning tools that can help avoid probate. A Wisconsin attorney fields your questions about estate planning and call in to be part of the discussion. Add your thoughts, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Chantel Ringy works on cases involving estate planning, elder law, and special needs planning. Chantel, once you do set up your documents and have those intentions, in those legal areas, those legal documents, how do you suggest communicating that information to loved ones or, multiple kids?
So what I typically recommend is that certainly you first make sure that whoever the persons are who you're naming as agent, to serve in various capacities in the event of your incapacity or your passing, that you talk with them first, make sure that they feel comfortable serving in that position, and ultimately that they know that they've been named. I also always recommend that clients provide a copy of their healthcare directives to their nominated healthcare agents in case they're ever called upon in the event of an emergency to make, quick healthcare decisions for you. Beyond that, our names are generally, the firm name is generally included on the documents themselves, so that if your, let's say, adult child locates your documents, and they should be told where they are. If they're in a safe deposit box at your bank, hopefully the child is named as an authorized person to access that box and they know where the keys are. Or if they're in a lockbox in your basement, hopefully they know where the key to that is or the code to get in. So let your agents know where the documents are so that they can be found if necessary, and make sure that they have a copy of your healthcare directive. So your doctor's office should also get a copy of your healthcare directive so that they know, or the emergency room knows if you end up there, who your agents are who should be contacted.
Christine emailed in to ask about a life estate. Christine established a life estate for their house and heard that the state of Wisconsin will claim part of this money if they need nursing home care in the future. And Christine's wondering how much of the value of their home would the state receive?
That is a question that I cannot answer without more information. And it really won't be discernible until their passing. And if she's married, if Christine is married, then it won't be until the passing of her and her spouse. It is correct. So a life estate, backing up, is this notion that you are transferring a future interest in your home, but you're preserving for yourself the right to live there as long as you're alive and prefer to live there. Or can live there. And so the owner has this retained interest. And it used to be that if you received long-term care Medicaid benefits during your lifetime and you had this life estate, when you passed away, the life estate interest went away and Medicaid's estate recovery rights could not apply to that life estate interest. But I believe it was 2014 when our statutes changed in that regard. Medicaid's estate recovery rights were broadened. And one of the things that became subject to their right of recovery are life estates. And so that's correct. If you have a life estate that was established after, I believe it's August 1st, August 1st of 2014. Then it, and if you've received long-term care Medicaid benefits or your spouse has, then there is likely to be some claim against that interest in the event of your death. The idea being, of course, this is a publicly funded program, and the federal government, in fact, I think mandates that our state government attempt to recover what it can from assets that remain from in the beneficiary's estate when they pass.
How do survivors deal with outstanding debts left by a deceased family member, especially in the situation of too little money remains in the estate to pay down the debt?
That's a good question. So our statutes do dictate sort of an order of priority when it comes to various creditors. And as you might imagine, the government is generally at the top of that list. Mm-hmm. So things like Medicaid or tax debt, you know, those types of debts certainly do take priority over a beneficiary's right to inherit, with some exceptions, I should say. But generally speaking, that's the case. Unsecured creditors, when there isn't enough money to go around, oftentimes they don't receive anything. And so that's part of the impetus behind the requirement to file the notice to creditors in the newspaper so that creditors at large, even if you don't know about who the creditors of your loved one might be, they have an opportunity and in many cases an obligation to file a claim so that they can be identified. And if there's an opportunity with money remaining to negotiate a reduced payback, perhaps their claim could be resolved. But otherwise, there are instances when if there's no money there, there's nothing to pay the creditors. And so, unfortunately, they are not always paid.
We're talking about estate planning and the probate process with Madison attorney Chantel Ringy. You can join in with questions and comments at 800-642-1234. Valerie is with us in Madison. Valerie, hi, go ahead.
Hi, I recently responded to a mailing solicitation to attend an estate planning workshop at which a free meal at a nice restaurant would be offered. And I researched a little bit behind the firm and found out that the attorney was licensed in Illinois, not Wisconsin. So I contacted the firm, and the attorney responded saying that they wrote up documents using a Zoom call with a licensed Wisconsin attorney. So I was just wondering about the, you know, about that whole situation.
Thanks, Valerie. Chantel, what are the implications of borderlines in a situation like that?
Well, the best advice is to have an estate planning meeting and have your estate plan drafted by and with an attorney who is licensed in the state where you reside. So maybe in that situation, there are a lot of cooks in the kitchen, it sounds like, and perhaps some of it has to do with who's better at marketing than the other. But you know, most people, I think, want to sit down with their estate planning attorney. It's during those discussions that so many important points arise. And if that attorney with whom you're having that meaningful discussion with is not licensed in the state of your residence, then they may be missing planning opportunities or other things that would jump out to someone who is. Someone who's licensed in Illinois could not prepare, for instance, a marital property agreement for someone in Wisconsin. And we often do prepare, in the context of an estate plan, a marital property agreement that can have a lot of value to the overall estate. I mean, Illinois is not a marital property state like Wisconsin is. And so there are certainly nuances in the laws between states, and it is very important that you meet with and do your planning with an attorney who's licensed where you live.
Along those lines, you know, how portable is your estate plan, for instance, if you do move to another state?
Good question. So just because you've relocated to a new state does not mean that you need to toss out your old documents and have an entirely new estate plan, but that is definitely an occasion when you should plan to sit down with an attorney, blow the dust off of your old state estate plan, and determine whether there are some updates that should be made. And if it's because of Wisconsin's very unique marital property laws, there are occasions when updates are warranted, or when someone's moving to Wisconsin from another state, you know, vice versa, when updates could be made that could be helpful. So that is one of the times of life, or one of the events of life, I should say, when meeting with an estate planning attorney to discuss any recommended updates is helpful.
Sandy has emailed in to ask, what are the initial steps to follow when a spouse dies, assuming that a will or an estate plan is established?
So one of the initial steps would be to review the estate plan. And oftentimes when it's a spousal situation, so there's a surviving spouse, there is no need for an actual probate proceeding, because many times most or all assets are set up in a way that they're either held jointly with the surviving spouse, or the surviving spouse was named as the beneficiary. And it sounds like this is an occasion when there was some planning done. So hopefully that's the case. Maybe you have a trust established already. It would probably warrant picking up the phone and giving a call to the attorney who drafted, or the law firm that drafted the estate plan, to just let them know that your spouse has passed, and get some pointers in terms of maybe who to call in the way of making claims on assets, or things that could be cleaned up. But when you've done planning, hopefully it's a short list and just a matter of, as I say, making phone calls, and not necessarily the case that you're going to have to petition the probate court.
There are online tools, as you know, for writing wills and other estate planning documents. Are there risks of filling out forms through these types of online services without the help of an attorney?
I think it's great that there are online tools available. I think the goal is to help meet a need that certainly exists. And some people don't have funds to sit down with an attorney, or for whatever reason, don't choose to do that. When that's not the case, when you do have some wealth, or when you do have what you know to be a complicated situation, like our caller earlier with the beneficiary with disabilities, those are situations in which it really does help to, it really does add value to have that conversation with a lawyer, because unfortunately, many of the online tools are set up in a way that they're sort of one size fits all, and you're not going to get the planning that might really be helpful for your loved one. And sometimes even when you think what you need is just a simple will, what you might be getting is not exactly what you intend. I mean, there is a reason why law school is 3 years and grueling. We do learn a lot in that process.
Chantel Ringy is an attorney in Madison, works on estate planning, elder law, and special needs planning. You can join the conversation at any point. Call in with a question. You can share your perspective, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We examine the transfer of assets after death and different facets of estate planning here in Wisconsin. And you can call in with a question, share your thoughts, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Chantel Ringy is a partner at the Madison law firm Hale Glowacki. Let's go to Leisha now in Spring Green. Leisha, hi, go ahead.
Hi. My brother passed away unexpectedly in early 2021, and he didn't leave a will. And so I had to go through Dane County probate. I'm in Sauk County, and I probably went there at least four times. And depending on who I talked to, some of the people I talked to there were wonderful, and others were not helpful at all, and I had a terrible time. I got through about two-thirds of it, and I finally got to a point where I consulted with an attorney. I hired an attorney, and they told me that I didn't have to do a final accounting, and I showed up at Dane County Probate, and they said, oh, yes, you absolutely do. So I had to go back home and do all that, and he had quite a bit in his estate, and it was quite a process. And so I paid that attorney $600 for bad information, and it really bothered me a lot.
Leisha, thank you for sharing such a personal story. And Chantel, what do you make of a story like that and having to go through a process that is so unexpected and certainly not something that people understand?
Yes, it can be frustrating. It can be a long, drawn-out process, and certainly it's filled with various documents that the probate court requires you to submit. And I don't know that I've ever had two probates that are the same. There are occasions when you can avoid the accounting requirement, but you need all of the beneficiaries to waive that properly in writing. But, you know, there's the inventory that you need to file. There's generally a final accounting, and then they want to make sure that you've done all necessary income tax filings. So there's a certificate that they want to see from the state of Wisconsin that attests to that. You know, there is an inventory fee that you need to pay the probate court. It's relatively small, but it is based on the size of the estate. So as Leisha said, when you have a larger estate, as in her case, you're going to have a larger inventory fee, and all of those things sort of compound to make a stressful situation in which you might be trying to grieve the loss of your loved one even more difficult. Not that they're trying to make it difficult for you, but you will hear from the folks at the Dane County Probate Court repeatedly that they are not lawyers and they're not authorized to give legal advice. And so I'm sorry to hear that you did not receive good legal advice or legal advice that was relevant for your situation, Leisha. But it generally can be very helpful to make a phone call to an attorney to just find out what it is that you need to complete and maybe get some help completing those documents if you need assistance. I'm sorry to hear about that experience. Yes, if he had done a bit of planning, then you probably could have avoided that.
Let's bring in Richard now in Milwaukee. Richard, hi. Richard, are you there?
I'm sorry to hear about that experience.
Okay, Richard, I don't think is there anymore. Is wondering who decides jurisdiction for legal documents, especially if you've moved?
So in terms of which state has jurisdiction, the probate, if you need a probate, that will be in the county where you passed away. Mm-hmm. So we frequently receive phone calls from loved ones who reside outside of Wisconsin, but their family member or friend passed away in the state, and they're having to open a probate in Wisconsin. Sometimes if you have real estate in multiple states, that might mean you have multiple probates too, which, you know, that definitely makes it even more valuable to have planning done in advance to avoid that process. So it's the county where the decedent resided when they passed away. Okay. That has jurisdiction of any probate. If they have documents drafted in another state, then generally the substantive provisions of those laws, that state's laws, apply, but the procedural laws of the state where you died apply in order to determine what procedures are required. So it can be kind of a mashup of the laws that apply in those situations.
Let's bring a question about wills now. Jeremy in Bayfield. Jeremy, hi.
Hi. I got a question that's related to copies of wills. My sister and brother and I are named as beneficiaries in a will, but we can't find the original will, and so the attorney that drew up the will has a copy. And I'm just wondering if we need to get a lawyer besides him to make sure that that the copy of the will is validated because there's a person that who's not named a sister of the deceased who may contest the whole thing.
Jeremy, thank you. Chantel, what about the validity of the will and copies?
So in Wisconsin, the probate courts will generally want to see the original of the will, and that's what they prefer to admit to probate. If that cannot be located, and certainly there are situations in which that's the case, maybe there was a fire or the individual moved numerous times or it just simply was displaced, then there are occasions when the probate court will accept a copy for admission to probate, but you have to convince them that it's valid and that the original wasn't revoked, because one manner of revoking a will is by destroying it. So who's to say that it wasn't destroyed, right? So usually, for instance, in Dane County, when we have situations where the original will cannot be located, certainly you want to make your best effort to find it, first of all, checking all of the sort of usual places. It sounds like you called the attorney who drafted the will. That's great. But when it can't be found in Dane County, if we submit an affidavit, you know, a sworn statement that it's that the copy is believed to be the will that was still in effect at the time of death, and that you've attempted to locate the original, unless there's a contest, then generally our probate court will accept that. But it sounds like maybe there's someone who perhaps would object. And it's in those cases where it becomes potentially more of a protracted argument about whether it is in fact the will that was in force at the time of death.
We only have a few seconds left. On wills, does Wisconsin recognize handwritten wills?
Wisconsin does. What our law wants to see, though, is that you have two disinterested witnesses who have watched the testator, or testatrix, the person signing the will, sign and have also signed it themselves.
Chantel, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. I've enjoyed the conversation.
Chantel Ringy is a partner at the Madison law firm Hill Glowacki, with practice areas that involve estate planning, that involve elder law and special needs planning. I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.